Excellent start. So what is the immune system? I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to, which is, I think, confusing to most of us. What is inflammation? We all have a basic understanding of inflammation, but I think it's in our best interest to make sure we're sort of understanding it the same way so we can continue to talk about it. I want to talk a little bit about acute versus chronic inflammation, and specifically the connection between chronic inflammation and chronic disease, because there is clearly a relationship there. I want to introduce you to lifestyle medicine, and then I want to talk most of the time about how lifestyle behaviors affect inflammation. I'm not going to tell her that doesn't work.
If you click on the PowerPoint, just like click on where your slide is and then try using the clicker, it should work. There we go.
All right, the clicker doesn't work, but I'll just stand here. All right, what is the immune system? The immune system is really amazingly distributed around the body. The basic function of the immune system is that it protects us from pathogens that can cause disease. And pathogens, pathos is a Greek word for suffering, and then gen is production of. So pathogens produce suffering, produce disease. And there are all kinds of pathogens. I mean, there are bacteria, viruses, fungi, all those things. But there are also things like cancer cells, which are the body will see as a pathogen, not me. Basically, the immune system responds to not me. Chemicals, pollens, all of you who suffer from seasonal allergies know, you know, that's the immune system. That's specifically a type of immune cell called the mast cell that releases histamine, which is why you take antihistamine so you don't have the itchy, watery eyes and runny nose and the sneezing, coughing. The immune system destroys these invaders. It actually helps to repair the damage by them. We will look into that a little bit in a moment. And it remarkably adapts to future challenges. That is, the more you study this, the more I study this, the more we study this, the more amazing it becomes to me. I mean, it is really, the human body is the most amazing machine that I can think of. It is truly miraculous to me. The more we understand, the more questions we have about what we're seeing and how it all interacts. And it's just an infinite number of questions after questions after questions. There are far more questions than answers. I think as we get into things like quantum computing and artificial intelligence and all the things that we're now dealing with, I think that we're going to be able to answer questions more quickly, and I think we'll have more answers. But I think it's going to just exponentially blow up the number of questions that we're going to be dealing with. Anyway, what we see here in the immune system is adenoids and tonsils, which many of us have now lost. Most of us, probably a lot of us in this room, have lost. I don't know if they still do that anymore like they used to, but we did a lot of tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies back in the day. The thymus gland right here below the breastbone is specifically spits out a specific type of immune cell called the T lymphocyte, which we'll talk a little bit more about. The spleen is involved in the immune system. The spleen is about as big around as your fist, and it's in your left upper quadrant of your abdomen, right behind your, tacked up against the diaphragm, right behind your stomach. And it filters blood. It does lots of things. It filters blood. It harbors white blood cells. It allows white blood cells to develop and mature before they're sent out into circulation. Lymph nodes, all of you who've had, everybody in the room, I'm sure, has had an infection with a swollen lymph node. That's the white blood cells that are congregating in that lymph node and then being dispersed out regionally to handle the infection that it's fighting. The bone marrow is part of the immune system. This is where all the white blood cells are formed and mature in their early development. And, of course, the skin and the mucosal membranes. The skin, the outer lining of our bodies, and the mucosal membranes, which are really the inner lining of our bodies, the gastrointestinal system, the genitourinary system, the respiratory system, those really are the first line of defense. I like to think of the immune system, I like to try to simplify everything so that I can understand it. So the immune system I see as composed of organs and tissues, the cells,
and then the molecules that those cells make. So the first line of defense is always the skin and the mucous membranes. We'll talk about that more in just a moment. And then the organs that we've mentioned. Cells, specifically, are the myriad types of cells, the white blood cells. The mast cells we mentioned, the macrophages, macro big phage eaters, so the big eaters. We'll look at those guys in a minute when we talk about atherosclerotic disease. And lymphocytes, the B lymphocytes, which are the cells that produce antibodies, and the T lymphocytes, which are the cells that directly kill these invader pathogens. And then all of the molecules that they make, including antibodies, cytokines. We'll talk about cytokines a little bit. Cytokine mover, kinetic, so cell movers. Complement proteins and histamines we've already mentioned. This is what happens with acute inflammation, and this is something that we're all very familiar with. When something harmful enters the body, here this splinter introducing these bacteria into the body, the red blood cell, the body will address that infection, that invader, by bringing more blood flow to that area and distributing those white blood cells to that area so that they can do what they need to do to heal the body. Acute inflammation is characterized by redness, because you've got more blood flow to that area now, by heat, because, again, you've got more blood flow to that area, swelling, because you've got more fluid and tissue activation going on, and pain, because you've got swelling around these nerve receptors. So those are the four cardinal signs of acute inflammation: redness, heat, swelling, and pain. It does the job. It repairs the damage. It gets rid of the pathogens. It repairs the damage. It's over. If you didn't have an acute inflammatory response, you'd be dead. Okay? It's like that reminds me of that story I watched when I was a kid about the boy who lived in the bubble. You know, didn't have the immune system. You can't go out. I mean, you get the flu and you're done. Chronic inflammation is something altogether different. Chronic inflammation is because we continually expose ourselves to chronic irritants. Things like cigarette smoke, environmental chemicals, excess cholesterol, alcohol, stress, disrupted sleep, obesity, all these things. And we're going to talk about each of these in more detail. Atherosclerosis, which is something that I do feel qualified to talk about, is a very good example of how chronic inflammation can contribute to, in this case, our number one cause of death in this country. I like to think of atherosclerosis as presenting in basically two ways. You can either have it slowly build up so that you get maybe a 70, 75%, 80% blockage in the artery, in which case your presenting symptom might be angina or angina. Exertional chest pain. You've got an 80% blockage. It's fine at rest. You're getting plenty of blood flow through the blockage. 20% blood flow with a heart rate of 50 and a blood pressure of 110 is fine. But when you start exerting yourself and your heart rate goes up to 140 and your blood pressure goes up to 180, which is what happens during exercise, now you can't, the heart's a muscle. That heart's working harder. It needs more blood flow. It can't get it because you have an 80% blockage and it begins to hurt. And that is called angina or angina. And that is a very common presenting symptom of atherosclerosis. Athera, gruel, I like root words. When I studied Latin in high school, I was the vocabulary guy. So I really just keep going back to root words. Athera is gruel, and sclerosis is hardening. So atherosclerosis, hardening of the gruel. The problem with cardiovascular disease is that too often it presents, as you see here in this lower brain, this complicated lesion at the bottom, this guy, where you've got, maybe you have a 40% blockage, which is not enough to cause angina. Even if you were walking up a mountain, you're not going to have angina if you only have a 40% blockage. The problem is if that blockage then cracks open and a blood clot forms on top of that blockage, you can go from a 40% completely asymptomatic blockage to 100% acute occlusion of your heart artery within minutes. And when that happens, the heart muscle downstream is now acutely not getting enough blood flow. It will begin to go into what we call ventricular fibrillation. It's basically like a seizure of the heart, electrical seizure. The heart's no longer pumping. And then that will, within minutes, will become asystole or flatline. And that is, that's the end. And undoubtedly, that's happened to someone, you know, a loved one of someone in this room. That's just statistically speaking, I'm sure that that's occurred. That is, unfortunately, the number one cause of, number one presenting symptom of symptomatic heart disease in this country is sudden death, sudden cardiac death from acute plaque rupture. Microscopically, this is what happens. At the top here, that sort of purplish area, that is the lumen. That's where the blood's traveling in your heart artery. There is one single cell layer lining of that artery here. These cells, these little rectangles, that is the endothelium. The endothelium is a single cell layer thick lining of all of your blood vessels. And it secretes nitric oxide, which is a vasodilator, which allows your artery, when you're exerting yourself and your heart needs more blood flow, you can actually dilate your blood flow so that you're getting, it maybe even 400, but at least 300% more blood flow at exercise than you are at rest. And that's a very adaptive response. What happens here when you get too much cholesterol, which is a pathogen in this instance, It will build up underneath this endothelium here, just under the lining in the wall of your artery. These white blood cells, the monocytes, will squeeze their way through these endothelial cells, come into what we call the subendothelial space, and these T cells, which I remember I just mentioned were one of the immune cells, T lymphocytes, will secrete cytokines, cell movers, which will cause these monocytes to transform into macrophages. The macrophages, remember big eaters, will literally engulf, eat these lipid particles and become what are called foam cells because they look like foam under light microscopy. Meanwhile, these cytokines secreted by these T cells will stimulate these smooth muscle cells, which are in all of your arteries and arterioles, to come in here. And they actually can eat some of the cholesterol too, but primarily they come in here and sort of create a barrier between this goo underneath the endothelium, these foam cells, and the circulating blood, creating what we call a fibrofatty plaque. Fibrous, connective tissue from the smooth muscle cells, fatty from the cholesterol, a fibrofatty plaque. When that fibrofatty plaque ruptures, it creates this complicated lesion at the bottom, which is what leads to sudden cardiac death. So constant irritants are one source of chronic inflammation. Unfortunately, another source of chronic inflammation in our country, in Western societies primarily, is autoimmune dysregulation. So when the immune system begins to go haywire, it will begin to recognize your own tissues as not your own tissues and will begin to stimulate immune response to fight yourself. And that's what happens in some of these autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, like lupus, inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. About a third of us have chronic inflammation. We can measure it in a number of ways, but the most common way to measure it is with blood tests, and we do that with, I'll mention these, so I'm mentioning them here now so that they will be familiar to you later. The most common is probably C-reactive protein, which is a very nonspecific marker of inflammation, but you may have heard that is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. It is. It is a risk factor for all chronic diseases. SED rate and erythrocyte sedimentation rate, or SED rate for short, is a very old blood test that we do that actually really measures how fast red blood cells sink in a tube. And then tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin 6, you don't need to remember those, but I am going to use those terms a couple times, so I want you to be passingly familiar with them. They are very commonly measured markers in research of chronic inflammation. And all of these chronic inflammatory states are associated with a number of chronic disease states. This is not a comprehensive list, but I want you just to recognize the breadth of the diseases that we see that are related to chronic inflammation. Cancers, neurologic diseases, pulmonary diseases, bone and joint disease, metabolic diseases, cardiovascular disease, and autoimmune diseases. Things like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, bronchitis, rheumatoid arthritis, fatty liver, stroke, heart failure, atherosclerosis, colitis, lupus, type 1 diabetes. This is a very comprehensive list of diseases that are all tied to chronic inflammation. This is data from the Center for Disease Control in 2023, and these are the top seven causes of death in the United States. No surprise to anyone, I don't think, in this room, that heart disease and cancer are number one and number two by a mile. But look at the other diseases here that are related to chronic inflammation. Stroke, chronic lower respiratory disease, Alzheimer's disease, and diabetes. The only one not related to chronic inflammation here is accidents. Alzheimer's disease has increased in incidence in the last 20 years by 90%. So something's going on, and it is related to inflammation. If you look at the actual causes of death, it looks more like this. Tobacco, poor diet and physical inactivity, alcohol consumption. You know, those are numbers one, two, and three, and those are all lifestyle-related behaviors, and we're going to talk about each of those. About 80% of our deaths are probably attributed to our lifestyle behaviors. What is lifestyle medicine? I like this definition, that it is the evidence-based practice of helping individuals and families adopt and sustain natural, healthy behaviors that affect health and quality of life. I have bolded a couple of things there. One is evidence-based, because I think it has to be evidence-based. Scientifically, I feel that it needs to be evidence-based. Not everything we need to do has to be strictly evidence-based. I mean, some things are just good ideas because they're good ideas. But when you're in medicine and you're going to be recommending, you know, specifically some dietary intervention, for example, instead of, or in addition to, but potentially instead of something else, a statin, for example, you better have some good data to hang your hat on or you're going to be in trouble. Right? I mean, this is not, you have to be evidence-based. And to some degree, and I don't feel this in the spirit of competition exactly, but the pharmaceutical companies are bombarding us, right, with all of these trials, which are a little bit, frankly, by the way, I'm not anti-medicine at all. I think that it's just not the foundation of the pyramid as we've built in this country. It is the apex of the pyramid. So lifestyle medicine has to be the foundation of the pyramid. That's what we need to build on. And then it's things like physical therapy and other natural remedies that will restore healthy balance, and then pills and procedures. So I'm not saying pills and procedures are evil. I'm saying that they can't be the foundation of our medical system because it makes no sense. It's too expensive. It's inefficient. Frankly, it's not very effective when it comes to treating chronic disease, as I'll show you with the Ornish data at the end of the presentation. But we do have to compete with them. So I didn't mean to discuss this morning, but when we are presented with this pharmacologic data, we're presented with this concept of absolute risk reduction. So if your risk of death is 2% of something, and I give you a medicine, and it reduces your risk to 1% of something, that is a 50% reduction in risk, right? I've cut it in half. I've cut it down from 2 to 1. So the relative risk reduction is 50%. So it is presented to us as this will reduce your risk of a heart attack by 50%. That is technically true. It does. But the absolute risk reduction is 2 to 1%. So you would have to treat 100 people with that intervention, in this case the drug, to prevent one of those events. That doesn't quite sell as well, right? So when we're looking at these interventions, I think it is very reasonable for us to put up these lifestyle interventions, and I'll show you some data in a moment. We should compare it to the medical data, and I am going to show you the medical data and specifically with the relationship to this Ornish program in a moment. And then healthy behaviors. I mean, it's ultimately with lifestyle medicine, I see three legs to the stool. And some of you have heard this before, but I'm going to keep beating this drum. It is education first, because you don't know what you don't know. And then it's integration. How do I take what I've learned and integrate it into meaningful behavior change? And then it's support. It's community support, so that we can continue making those changes so that the healthy choice is the easy choice. And, you know, our environment today here in the world, but specifically in Western world, is not set up to sustain those sorts of behaviors. So
these are the things that we focus on with lifestyle medicine, going around from green around the clock, clockwise, healthful eating of whole plant-based foods predominantly, we'll, more on that, a lot more on that, increasing physical activity, managing stress, forming and maintaining relationships, improving your sleep, and avoiding risky substances. Or said differently, eating plants, keep moving, sleep well, be present, stay calm, love people. So however you wish to remember that, that's really what we're talking about with lifestyle medicine. And honestly, it sounds so simple as to be almost too simple. You know, what am I supposed to do with that? Well, let's dive in a little bit deeper. This is the anti-inflammatory lifestyle. It's eating anti-inflammatory foods, not smoking, limiting alcohol intake, exercising, moving regularly, good quality sleep, managing stress, managing weight. I'm going to talk about each of those separately. I'm going to talk about diet first because I think it's such a cornerstone habit. This is the inflammatory diet, and it is primarily characterized by an excessive intake of simple carbohydrates, meaning sugars and refined grains, specifically white flour, white bread, to some lesser degree white rice, and unhealthy fats. There are three macronutrients in your diet. They are fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. That is easy to remember. I do not believe in vilifying any of them. You know, there's so much confusion and noise around, and we can talk a little bit about it, and I will talk a little bit about it. Low fat, high fat, low carb, high carb. Nobody ever really seems to talk about protein except are we getting enough of it? We can talk about that too in Q&A if that's a question. I don't have all the answers, but I enjoy the conversation. It is just, we need to think more about what are the right carbs, what are the right proteins, what are the right fats. That's really what we need to be focusing on. We eat way too many of these refined carbohydrates, and that causes a very quick rise in our blood glucose levels. That is a high glycemic load. Foods with a high glycemic load load our blood vessels with sugar quickly. Lower glycemic loads, picture a high glycemic load is a big spike, a fast spike of a blood sugar, and then it comes down. A lower glycemic load is more of a rounded, you know, a gentle hill. So you're still getting the same amount of glucose potentially, but it's going to be distributed over an hour and a half, 2 hours, instead of over 10 minutes. And the insulin will follow that. The insulin's job is to try to drive that blood sugar into the cells where it can be used as the fuel for everything that we're doing. And so the insulin will follow the blood sugar, and it will cause, over time, rapid insulin and high insulin spikes will cause chronic inflammation. And then trans fats, I put trans fats here, but I probably should have put trans fats and saturated fats. Trans fats have been outlawed since about 2020-ish, 2019, 2020, somewhere in that range. But we predominantly found them in hydrogenated vegetable oils. Vegetable oils, corn oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, canola oil, they are liquid. They're oils. But when we hydrogenate them, they become solids. I mean, think Crisco, which has been around since, I don't know, 100 years. And it's still around. But it doesn't have any, they had to reformulate their science. So it's kind of been an interesting time to be in a food lab, I think, when the government said you can't use trans fats anymore because they're the worst things you could put in our bodies as far as our lipids go. They raise bad cholesterol, they lower good cholesterol, they raise triglycerides, they do everything in the wrong direction. So they reformulated Crisco. It's still not a health food. I wouldn't eat it with a spoon. But it is, it doesn't contain trans fats anymore. And then saturated fats are predominantly, I think I have it on this next slide. Saturated fats are predominantly found in animal products. There are a lot of saturated fats, specifically in palm oil and in coconut oil, which is coconut oil is about 90% saturated fat. But most of the saturated fats in our diets by far, 99%, are from animal products. Plants do make fats, and the fats that are found in plants are monounsaturated, MUFAs, monounsaturated fatty acids, and polyunsaturated fatty acids. MUFAs and PUFAs are in the plants. We have in this country an abnormal ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. Both omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids are PUFAs. They're polyunsaturated fatty acids. Omega-6s have been sort of vilified, and they aren't. It's not that omega-6s are necessarily bad for us.
It's just that we eat way, our ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 is way out of balance. Generally speaking, an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, which you, I'm sure, have not had tested, but it can be tested, it's a blood test, is ideally around 4 to 1. And the average in the United States is more like 15 or 20 to 1. And that is very much an inflammatory ratio. We eat a lot of fried foods. We eat a lot of processed meats. You know, I grew up in Columbia, South Carolina. It was Vienna sausages and sausage and bacon for breakfast and, you know, turkey sandwich with more bacon for lunch. And it was a bit of a mess. Hopefully some of that damage is being reversed. And then how does this lead to chronic inflammation in the first place? Well, there are lots of mechanisms, but the one that I keep, the one that makes the most sense to me is that when we eat these things, we are damaging the lining of the gut in a number of ways. And this is a whole two-hour lecture itself. I'm not going to go into detail here, but it damages the lining of the gut, which really causes leaky bowel. And these molecules that should be staying in the gut can get into the bloodstream and cause an allergy-like response. And then you start having problems with things like irritable bowel syndrome and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and lots of GI disturbances, inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. The anti-inflammatory diet is very much a Mediterranean-type eating plan. And I see all of this as a spectrum, by the way. I'm probably 95% plant-based. I occasionally do eat non-plant foods. I go to the beach with my friends once a year and we catch a fish, I'll eat it. When my mother-in-law visits and she likes cheese, we'll have a piece of cheese. You know, those sorts of things. I'm not 100%. I see it as more a pattern. The pattern is you need to eat a lot more plants, and we need to eat fewer simple sugars. We need to eat fewer saturated fats. We need to incorporate lots of colors in our diet. And I know you've heard this, and I don't mean to belabor the point, but we've got to eat, you've heard eat the rainbow. Well, the reason that we've said that is that there are innumerable 10,000 or more phytochemicals, phytoplant chemicals, plant chemicals, and antioxidants in those foods. And those, they're advertising themselves in their colors. So in the reds, for example, we see a lot of anthocyanins. In the oranges and the yellows, we see lots of beta carotene. In the greens, we see lots of chlorophyll. We are needing to eat those colorful foods because of the chemicals, the anti-inflammatory chemicals that they contain. So when I go to the grocery store, I really do, when I'm walking around the produce section, I'm really thinking to myself, you know, Roy G. Biff, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, or the rainbow, whatever works for you, the colors of the rainbow. I'm thinking about, you know, what do I have this red? What do I have this blue? Oh, I don't have a yellow yet. I don't have an orange. I really am thinking that way. There's lots of other doctors who've come up with ways to do this. Some of you may be familiar with Dr. Furman and his G-bombs, greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds as the things that we should be. This is really for him an ideal anti-cancer diet. And then Dr. Greger, some of you may be familiar with Michael Greger and his Daily Dozen. That's his Daily Dozen, and it looks a lot like the Mediterranean-style eating plan, doesn't it? I mean, it's lots of beans and fruits and berries. Cruciferous vegetables are things like broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, grains, greens, vegetables, and then he throws in flax seeds, nuts, spices, beverages, and exercise. You know, again, whatever works for you, but that's what your diet should be centered around. Do you have to be perfect? No. You can choose to be, and we can talk about protein because I'm sure that'll come up. Fruits, veggies, beans, whole grains, nuts, and seeds. Rebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics. So I think everybody in the room probably has heard the term probiotics, right? Bacteria. Probiotics are just the bacteria that you want in your gut. And you can take it as a capsule. That's fine. I mean, people are definitely happy to sell you probiotic capsules or powders or whatever else. Absolutely fine. But you can get them from your food, and they're more alive when they're in the food. So they're primarily in fermented foods, things like kimchi, sauerkraut, kombucha, yogurt, kefir, those sorts of things. Eat real foods. The prebiotics are the fiber that are fed to the probiotics. And there's all kinds of different fibers. I don't know how many thousands of different types of fibers. Different fibers feed different bacteria. So prebiotics are the fiber food for the probiotics. The probiotics then will produce postbiotics, which are short-chain fatty acids. Things like acetate, butyrate, propionate. There's multiple types of short-chain fatty acids. The short-chain fatty acids are the miracles. I mean, those are the things that are helping us with reducing inflammation, with brain health, with gut health, with everything. And you can also buy them. But the cheapest and easiest way to do it, since you have to eat anyway, buy more plants, eat more fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts, seeds, and whole grains, and feed your bacteria. Red and purple berries are particularly rich in phytochemicals. You know, if you are concerned about, I am aware, not overly concerned, but aware about my brain health because my mother died of Alzheimer's at 76 and I'm 57. And her father died of Alzheimer's at 67. So, you know, I've talked to Dr. Shirzai, a man and woman neurologist in California, who do a lot of work in Alzheimer's, and what are the top things that you should be eating? And they would say leafy greens, beans, and red and purple berries. So I had this morning for breakfast my green smoothie with kale and Wyman's triple berry blend, and it's a good start. I mentioned omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-3 fatty acids, there are several types of omega-3 fatty acids. When most of us think of them, we think of fish oil, and that's fine. It is certainly in fish oil. It's in fish, and it's in algae. The fish get it from the algae. So if you are, if you seek to be 100% plant-based, no animal products, then by all means, you can get those omega-3 fatty acids from algae, algal sources. If you can also take fish oil, and you can eat, as they do in the Mediterranean areas, they eat about a 3.5 ounce of serving of fatty fish like salmon or sardines or tuna about twice a week. And 3.5 ounces is, by the way, about the size of a deck of cards. So this is not a big piece of fish. Limit saturated fats we've already talked about. Herbs and spices have lots of polyphenols, which are very anti-inflammatory. So we definitely want to include them. And when I think of the one that most people think about, and it was on Gregor there, that spice, everybody probably would look at that spice serving down there at the bottom and say, that's turmeric, right? And we, of course, want to figure out what's the magic bullet in turmeric, which is we think one of the magic bullets is curcumin. And so what we really want to do is make curcumin supplements and sell those to you. But you can just add turmeric. And by the way, one serving a day, that's a half a teaspoon. Half a teaspoon. Half a teaspoon of turmeric or any of these herbs and spices. And the more, the better. We put them in everything. I mean, I put cardamom, nutmeg, and cinnamon in my oatmeal in the morning along with flax meal. I take turmeric. I just put it in water and drink it. There's some turmeric teas that I like. You know, the more anti-inflammatory spices, the better. I've already talked about those foods. People are sometimes surprised that the Mediterranean diet is relatively high in fat. So it's about 30 to 50% fat on the typical Mediterranean diet. And again, don't think about fat as just as fat. Is it saturated fat, trans fat, polyunsaturated fat, or monounsaturated fat? Only about 8% of the fat intake in the Mediterranean diet is saturated fat intake, and it's all from animal products, with exception of coconut and palm. So maybe some coconut, but probably not in the Mediterranean region. Lots of monounsaturated fatty acids in olive oil and avocado oil. Lot lower omega-6-3 ratio than in the standard American diet. and tons of fiber. I don't pay any attention personally to fiber guidelines, but these are the guidelines from the National Academy of Medicine, 21 grams a day for women and 30 grams a day for men over 50. The average fiber intake on the Mediterranean diet is about 32 grams per day. If you're eating a 90% or more plant-based diet, you are guaranteeing that you're getting all the fiber that you need. You don't need to take a fiber supplement. You will find that your bowels are moving very regularly, frankly, more than once a day for most people eating a plant-based diet. I had lunch. Some of you may know Will Bolsiewicz. He wrote a book called Fiber Fueled. I was down at the beach last week, and I cold called him and said, "Well, you don't know me. We've not met, but I know you, and I would like to meet you." And so we had lunch, and we started talking about lots of things. We actually had a really good conversation about spirituality and didn't speak much about diet at all. But when we did, we talked about this recommendation of 30 plants a week. The more different types of fiber you can get from all the different things, don't always eat the same thing when you go to the grocery store. Don't always get the Vidalia onion, the green bell pepper, and the mushrooms, and eat it all week. Next week, get something different. Get a red onion, broccoli, and you get the point. More fiber, more different fiber sources, more diversity in your microbiome, more postbiotics, different postbiotics, more stuff that your body needs. Spread the wealth. Fiber is underappreciated for sure. It controls blood sugar. It regulates our bowels. It lowers the risk of colon cancer, manages our weight, lowers cholesterol. It does everything that we want. I am fascinated by the microbiome, and I'm not going to go into great detail here, but one time I would love to come back and speak about the microbiome specifically. The microbiome is the genetic material. The right term is probably microbiota, the microbes that live in us and on us, and the microbiome is the genetic material contained in those bacteria. There is clearly a connection between your gut and your brain. And I find this super fascinating. My younger son's 19, thinks he wants to potentially, he's either going to be a biostatistician in the NBA or cure cancer. And if he decides to go the cancer route, I really would like him to learn more about this concept of the microbiome. And specifically, the psychobiome is interesting to me. What do we need to be eating to feed our brains? The gut bacteria produce GABA and serotonin. Serotonin probably might ring a bell for some of you, because for people who are suffering from clinical depression, the most commonly prescribed pharmacologic solution to that would be a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, something like a Zoloft or a Paxil, one of those. About 95% of our serotonin in our body is actually produced in our gut. So I think this is super fascinating that they have done mice studies with fecal transplantation. And they're doing fecal transplantation in humans too. I mean, if you have a condition caused by antibiotics called C. diff, Clostridium difficile colitis, one of the refractory C. diff colitis is treated with fecal transplantation. We will literally get a poop slurry and with an enema tube, and we will squirt it into your backside, and it will repopulate your bacterial growth, and it will cure the colitis. We have done in some human studies an antegrade approach with an esophageal tube with poop slurry, which only college students are signing up for, because they need the money. But they have done these studies in mice, which I think is just fascinating. They've taken, I don't know how you determine whether a mouse is depressed, but I'm not kidding. You can do this. So they took depressed mice and not depressed mice. And they took poop samples from both mice and they switched them. They gave the poop from the non-depressed mice to the depressed mice and the depressed mice to the non-depressed mice, and they switched. The non-depressed mice became depressed and vice versa. Now, if that can happen in humans, that is really fascinating. That might be something that we should explore, and we are, but it gives rise to this whole concept of psychobiome.
Interestingly, I looked this up the other day, and I wrote it down, so I'm going to tell you. The number of so your genes encode for proteins. Your genes, and those are sections of your DNA, encode for proteins. They build your body. The number of protein-coding genes in the microbes that are in you and on you, there are 10 times more bacteria in us and on us than there are cells in our body. The number of protein-coding genes in the microbes versus the number of protein-coding genes in human DNA is 360 to 1. There are 360 to 1. So, and it's almost like we're just transportation mechanisms for bacteria. I mean, it's just awesome stuff. So, maintaining healthy weight. I want to talk about this. There are just a few points that I want to make. One is there are a couple types of fat. There are subcutaneous fat, which is the fat, you know, we get around our middle or, you know, we don't like it, but we had it. And then there's visceral fat, which is the fat that surrounds our organs inside. If I cut your abdomen open and look at your intestines and your liver and your pancreas and your spleen and everything, there's a variable amount of fat that's going to be surrounding those organs. You can have a lot of visceral fat, not a lot of subcutaneous fat, and you can have little visceral fat and a lot of subcutaneous fat. Most of us have plenty of both. The visceral fat directly promotes inflammation by releasing these IL-6 and tumor necrosis factor and those sorts of things directly into the bloodstream. I wanted to make a point of how we measure visceral fat. Most of us don't have any idea of our visceral fat. We are familiar with this idea of body mass index. A body mass index is free and cheap, and you can do it on anyone. It's a weight to height ratio, essentially, and it tells you how much it estimates how much visceral and subcutaneous fat you are carrying. Under 25 is normal. 25 to 30 is overweight. 30 to 40 is obese, and over 40 is morbidly obese. We use it all the time in medical studies because it doesn't cost anything. It is a very insensitive way of measuring body fat because you can't really see inside. So the gold standard is a DEXA scan, which they have here at UNCA. But there are lots of other things, like there's an in-body machine and a bod pod, and there's lots of other ways to measure visceral fat. I want to talk about the ketogenic diet for a minute and then intermittent fasting. Ketogenic diet, because I know this is going to be a question. I'm just nipping this in the bud, maybe. Ketogenic diet is a high-fat diet and a low-carb diet. And again, remember, I don't like the terms high-fat or low-carb or any of that. What are we eating? So the Nutrition Science Initiative study, what we did is we took people who were eating a 50% carb, 35% fat, 15% protein diet. That's a very reasonable dietary pattern that could look a lot like a Mediterranean-style eating pattern. That could look a lot like a plant-based eating pattern. It could look a lot like a standard American diet eating pattern. And then we made it a five carb, 80% fat, 15% protein, kept the protein the same. We did it for a month, and then we switched it for a month. And this was an isocaloric diet. Okay, we're giving you the same number of calories so that's not a confounder. More weight loss was noted on keto, but, and this is a big but, the body fat loss decreased by more than 50%. So you're losing a lot of that weight loss was water weight, and some of that weight loss was lean muscle mass weight, which you don't want to lose lean muscle mass. We want to lose visceral, maybe subcutaneous fat, but you don't want to lose lean muscle mass. Obviously, there are fewer probiotics or prebiotics. There's less fiber in that diet. And it's nutrient. We are generally overfed and undernourished in this society. We're getting plenty of calories, but we're not getting the nutrients we need. And so some of you who shop at Whole Foods Market may remember the days when they were using the ANDI, the Aggregate Nutrient Density Index, that Dr. Furman invented, and John Mackey bought it from Furman and then ended up not using it. The ANDI for kale is 1,000. So you get a lot of nutrients, and you get very few calories. So the nutrient-to-calorie ratio is off the charts high. That's the highest one, by the way, is 1,000. Compare that to 54 for an 8-ounce chicken breast. So you're getting a lot more calories and fewer nutrients. So we don't eat fat, carbs, and protein. We eat food. So we need to be thinking about what foods we eat.
In the keto specimens, we found that they were inadequate intake of 17 micronutrients. So I tell my patients who I'm on a keto diet, I'm losing weight, I'm not getting off this thing. I have no intention of abandoning my keto diet. I would say, you know, what kind of keto diet are you eating? Because you can eat an animal-based keto diet, and you can eat more of a plant-based keto diet with the fats coming from plants. And I would tell them that last line, that if you're eating animal fat, you got a 50% increased risk of heart attack or stroke, and there was no increased risk if you were doing keto with plant fats. I'm thinking things like avocados, lots of avocados. I would also tell them if you're eating the animal fat keto diet, that at least take a multivitamin. Intermittent fasting comes up a lot. It's alternate day fasting, 5-2 fasting. So fasting really specifically means I have not eaten for 24 hours. I want to distinguish that from time-restricted eating, which many of us are doing, where you're at a minimum, you want your gut to be giving a rest for 12 hours. That's pretty easy, really pretty easy, right? So when you are, after about 12 hours, your body will go from burning carbs as its primary source of fuel to burning fat. It just starts around 12 hours. So you want to give yourself at least 12 hours, which is fine. If you ate dinner at 7 and you don't eat breakfast until 7 in the morning, it's 12 hours. Easy. What is harder is to go maybe skipping breakfast and going to, I'm not going to eat until, I'm going to only eat 2 meals a day, and I'm going to eat in an 8-hour or 6-hour window. You know, when you do that, you do get some loss of total body weight, but only about 2%. I mean, some people, it's a bell-shaped curve. Some people are going to lose a lot of weight. Some people aren't going to lose a lot of weight, but it varies. And there are some benefits. There are some other benefits, as you see there. I need to speed up a little bit. Maybe there's some lifespan extension. That's not entirely clear to us yet, and that's still widely debated. But there are some people, Walter Longo, the longevity diet, the director of the University of Southern California Center for Longevity, definitely would say that there's a lifespan extension. It is true that in other species, from worms to from yeast to worms to monkeys, that when we calorie restrict them, they do live longer. They do live longer. We can maybe talk about this a little bit later, but in the interest of time, I just want to share. This was in the Atlantic in December. A friend of mine shared this with me and said, what do you think? I don't like, I mean, I do think there's a role for these GLP-1s. I mean, I'm sure somebody's on them and has lost weight. And people are very satisfied with these drugs because they finally lose their weight easily. And I think there's probably a role, you know, for these things in some people. What I don't agree with is that this is replacing anything. If you do not change your lifestyle behaviors and you don't change the way that you're eating, you're going to be on this drug for life if you want to maintain that body weight. I don't know that that's, you know, there's a lot of cost to that and potential side effects, et cetera. We can come back to that if there's time. I want to talk about physical activity for a minute. There are physical activity guidelines, and the United States publishes every 10 years. These are from 2018. The next ones will be obviously in 2028. The guidelines for physical activity, and the guideline is 150 minutes a week of moderate level physical activity. And that's usually 30 minutes, 5 days a week. You might have heard that. You can break it down into 10-minute increments, so you can do 10, 10, 10. If you want to blunt your insulin spikes, the best time to do your 10, 10, 10 would be after breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And blunt those insulin spikes. Go for a 10-minute walk after you eat, or at least a 10-minute something. 20% reduction in all-cause mortality from going from sedentary to 150 minutes a week. That's the steepest part of that curve. There is no level of activity where more is not better, as far as we know. You can overtrain and get hurt and increase your risk of injury, but from a mortality benefit, there was no, you know, how much is too much. It does lower inflammation. Physical activity lowers inflammation. This is from Cancer Epidemiology. Lower levels of inflammation in people getting regular physical activity. Another one, a single 20-minute brisk walk on a treadmill reduced the number of immune cells that produce tumor necrosis factor. Another one, this is a meta-analysis where we take a bunch of different studies and put them together so that they have more participants. 11 studies, 1,250 participants. This was in healthy middle-aged people, and it was getting 150 minutes of activity a week. CRP, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, all down. as we age, there are a number of things that lead to increasing disability. On a cellular level, there's oxidative damage and inflammation. On an organ system level, there's endothelial dysfunction and arterial stiffness and loss of muscle strength and muscle mass. Lose it, use it or lose it. It's true throughout our lifespan. Ultimately, that leads to frailty and then disability, and exercise intervenes at every level. Exercise, I'm sure there's some Peter Attia fans in the room. Peter is definitely not going to avoid the nutritional piece, which I think is, I really believe is a disservice. But I understand that he doesn't want to take that on. He's just going to, his niche is physical activity. They are both incredibly important from an inflammation standpoint and a longevity standpoint. What about stress? Here's an article from Human Neuroscience. Cortisol activates the immune system, triggering a sustained systemic inflammatory response. All of us are probably familiar with cortisol, which is one of our stress hormones. It does all these things to us. It impairs our cognitive performance. It does all these things. Note, lowered immune function over there on the right and slower wound healing. It leads to all of these problems: anxiety, depression, impaired attention, inflammation, oxidation, brain atrophy, beta amyloid accumulation, which is the protein that is accumulating in our brains when we look at brains of people who have succumbed to Alzheimer's. And of course, in the United States, our focus has been on making drugs that will get rid of beta amyloid, which is just such a, I get it, but it's just such a short-sighted approach. We're not getting to the root cause of the problem. We're going to find a symptom, and we're going to target a symptom with a drug that will alleviate the symptom, but we're not really sure. It's not the only thing going on. So does it work? Does it not work? Half the time it doesn't work. As you all know, anybody who has an interest in this knows that the drugs that we currently have for Alzheimer's are very ineffective. And there was a lot of hullabaloo around the last one that we approved that really didn't seem to do anything. How do we lower cortisol levels? Well, we were talking about meditation. It's meditation. It's yoga. It's anything that you do. Spending time in nature is anything that you do that puts you in flow and allows you to get your mind off of the minutiae that are driving us crazy. And most of the stuff that's causing our stress today in our Western world is stuff that we've kind of hoisted upon ourselves, right? It's my inbox is full, or I'm never going to get there because of traffic, or it's just made up stuff. Sleep. 35% of U.S. adults don't get a minimum of 7 hours a night. We have done these experiments on people where it was medical students, where we sleep deprived them, and then we followed what they ate. On average, they ate about 500 calories more after a sleepless night than a restful night, and most of those calories were from simple carbohydrates, which is going to just speed up that whole inflammatory process. Sleep apnea, I just want to say, is a sleep emergency or urgency. If you have or are concerned that a loved one has sleep apnea, they're not breathing at night, please bring that to the attention of your physician or that person's physician. That needs to be dealt with because that is dangerous. It's about severe sleep apnea increases your risk of Alzheimer's dementia by about 70% and is about as risky to your heart as a pack-a-day smoking habit. This is interesting. These subjects were kept awake from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. This is IL-6 on the left and tumor necrosis factor on the right. The gray is pre. That's a level of 1. When you're kept awake for 4 hours for one night, your IL-6 levels increased 3.5 times and your TNF-alpha levels doubled. One night of restless sleep. And I don't panic if you've had restless sleep. It happens to everyone. Just don't try to stack those nights. If you are having trouble sleeping, whether it's getting asleep or staying asleep, you know, why is that? Ask yourself, really be mindful about why that is. I can tell you for me, I was sleepy. If I read a book, I was falling asleep, which is good, but I didn't want to fall asleep at 8:30 because I don't want to wake up at 4:30. I don't want to go to sleep around 10 and I want to wake up at 6. I'm trying to, you know, thread the needle. So I didn't fall asleep if I was watching Netflix. I mean, I didn't. It's the truth. So I would watch Netflix so I could stay awake. And then I would close it and I'd go to sleep fine. But I would find myself waking up at 3. And I'm like, what is going on? And then I thought, you know, maybe it's the blue light from the screen. stopped doing that, started reading, did fall asleep earlier, and I started sleeping much better. So these are just some sleep, some healthy sleep habits. I'm happy to share all these slides with everyone. You know, trying to maintain a regular sleep schedule so that you're getting up. It's hard for some of us who are working, particularly shift workers, particularly doctors, or healthcare people. But it's best to go to sleep and wake up on the same one every night. Avoiding stimulants is probably just a good idea. You get the idea. I'm not going to go through all these in the interest of time. Happy to share all this with you. But one comment on exercise and daylight. It is very important if you want to sleep well that you expose your eyes, your brain, which your eyes are your extension of your brain directly. You need to expose your brain to morning sunlight. It is ideal if you can exercise while you're doing that, and it's double bonus points if you can exercise in nature while you're doing that. So if you can walk outside in the morning, you don't have to get up right at sunrise, but when you get up, whether or not you've had your cup of coffee or whatever you're doing, try to make it a habit that you're going outside and exposing yourself to morning sunlight for at least 10 to 15 minutes so that you can train your brain to release the chemicals that will put you to sleep at night at the appropriate time. You're setting your circadian rhythm. Just a few words on alcohol, because it comes up a lot. Moderate alcohol use, which they defined as one drink a day for women and two for men, is associated with lower levels of IL-6, TNF-alpha, but it's a J-shaped curve. Once you go up past that, your inflammatory markers start to increase again. I would never, and I will never, recommend alcohol as an anti-inflammatory. It is associated with 13 different types of cancers, and you can choose to drink. I drink, not excessively, but I do drink regularly. I have a glass of wine with dinner at least 5 days a week. That's probably more than I need if I'm honest. But I enjoy it, and I'm still doing it. But I'm doing it knowing that there is some risk in doing that. Enough on the alcohol. And tobacco, it really goes without saying, but I didn't feel like I could not mention it. Cigarette smoking is a major source of toxic chemical exposure, and it really wreaks havoc on our inflammatory system. If you are a smoker, that is the first thing that I would try to get rid of. No judgment. It's incredibly addictive, incredibly addictive. And in the order of emergence things that I need to change, that is number one. I said I would talk about Ornish. I'm going to close with this. I loved being the medical director of the Ornish program. The Ornish program, it was a four-hour event for participants twice a week for 9 weeks. Huge commitment, time commitment. Very challenging for patients who were working to participate in the program. It was 1 hour of nutrition. We would lecture about nutrition and feed you a plant-based diet. We would exercise for an hour. We would do stress management for an hour, which was essentially hatha yoga and meditation. And we would have group support for an hour. As the medical director of the program, I could participate in all components except for the group support piece. That was closed. That was a licensed clinical social worker and professional counselor and a cohort of people to talk about the trauma of having had heart transplant or sudden death. And a lot of stuff came up, and it was felt that that is best kept in the group. Everybody, 90% of people, when they left that program, said that that was the most important part of the program, which is really interesting to me because it was the part of the program that I didn't have direct access to, but it was a big teaching point to me that it's the social connection, or as Dean would say, eat better, move more, stress less, love more. It's the love more piece which was the key. It's the glue. I mean, it's the top of the pyramid. It's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. That's what we're moving toward. I believe physical health is the foundation, and then mental, emotional, cognitive health. But ultimately, it's social, community, spiritual health. So what Ornish did was he took people with 40% blockages and split them into two groups. The black circles were treated with conventional medical therapy. Statins, aspirin, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, all the stuff. The white squares were treated with no medicines and with that program that I just described. And they followed them for 5 years. And in 5 years, you got another heart cath. The medical group had a 28% relative worsening. more blockage, more cholesterol buildup. The orange group had 8% improvement, but were on no meds. As a clinical cardiologist, that's interesting, but what I care about is, do you feel better and do you live longer? There was a 91% decrease in angina in the orange group and a tremendous increase in angina on the group that included anti-anginals. In 5 years, there was 2.5 fewer events in the orange group, or increased events in the medical group, however you want to say that. You did better if you weren't on the meds and you were making the lifestyle changes that led to less inflammation and fewer cardiovascular events. Statins, no statins, the LDL reduction was the same, and they increased their coronary heart, reversed their coronary heart disease with an average of 300% increase in their blood flow on stress test. I mean, it's close to a panacea as I've seen in medicine. We measure all the things because we have to measure the things to show people. They don't really get the love more piece initially. You have to show them a number. So we did, and all these things moved in the right direction. The depression score at the bottom was down 50%. The exercise capacity was up by 50%. That's absolutely 100% quality of life. Those are quality of life metrics that are worth something. So chronic inflammation really is the common denominator, or at least a common denominator, in basically all of our chronic diseases, if you remember that slide with all the multiple diseases. I borrowed this quote from Aristotle and changed it to, "You are what you repeatedly do. Excellent health, then, is not an act, but a reflection of your health habits." He says, "You are what you repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not a habit. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit." And our lifestyle behaviors, our habits, really do, it works. It's hard to get people to do it. It's hard to get people to sometimes to take the medicine. But it works better than the medicine that we're being prescribed. And to not bring some attention to it and have that conversation with people and with patients is, I would go so far as to say that's unethical. So. Calcium score of zero. However, there's never a right answer for these things. I have a friend who had a calcium score of zero, but was having what sounded like angina. And she had a CT angiogram, which is a more detailed CAT scan. She had a calcium score of zero, but she had a non-calcified 60% plaque that did rupture and did cause her to have a small event. She was unscathed, thank goodness, and they stented it. And she is on a statin. I definitely would recommend a statin to her. She already eats a very plant-forward diet, nearly perfect. And I'm trying to do everything. So I can you can never say yet, always or never in medicine, but statistically, you're not expected to have a reduction in events in your case. It's a long way of saying I don't really know, but I've told you everything I do know. Yes, sir.
My name is Lou Lieb. based on my reading and research in the nutritional field, I have the impression that the research around saturated fat is kind of ambiguous, that it's not considered the boogeyman that it once was. And I was reading one author who even said it was good for you.
Yeah. So, you know, this is, this nutritional science is just so hard. It is very hard to do it because we end up doing epidemiologic studies. It's hard to do a randomized controlled study with nutrition, because you can't, it's just so hard to control what people eat unless you lock them in a room. I mean, you could do an RCT, a randomized controlled trial of something like saturated fat for 2 weeks, maybe. But to do it for long enough to see these curves diverge is challenging. I have seen that. I'm aware of that. There are a couple of really outspoken people in social media. My feeling and the position of most physicians in the space, in the nutritional space, is that the preponderance of data still suggests that saturated fat is a primary driver of serum lipid levels, and that there is still, we know that lower cholesterol reduces event rates, not in all people. So, you know, there may be some of us who have, you can eat, we'll say, pick a number, 20% saturated fat. I eat 5% saturated fat,
and our risks are the same. And if I put you on a lower fat diet, you wouldn't have been felt to benefit.
So we don't know for sure, but I would say that the preponderance of data supports that saturated fat is not best for the majority of us. There may be some of us for whom that is not true, but I don't know how to identify those people. Interesting. And again, I don't know. I'm going to say I don't know to everything. Because I don't. I mean, I don't know that we know. But I'm just telling you what I think we know. Yeah.
Thank you for being here and all this great info. Could you speak about anemia, what causes it, and what you recommend to help?
Anemia? So there are different causes of anemia, too. Anemia is just not enough red blood cells in your bloodstream. The most common, if we just think about what causes, how could this happen? You know, you're either not producing enough of them, which is not the most common scenario, but it's possible that you have some sort of bone marrow problem and you're not producing enough red blood cells. More commonly, it's a loss problem and we're losing the blood somewhere. In menstruating women, that is, you know, a common cause of a mild anemia, menstrual cycle. In most people with anemia, common things being common, it would be GI blood loss. And we would want to make sure that we're checking that you're not losing those red blood cells. So we want to check for blood in the stool. We do a stool test to make sure there's no blood in the stool. And if there was, we would want to look into that. We would want to do, you know, that's when you start talking about things like colonoscopy and these sorts of things to look for a bleeding source somewhere in the intestine that we aren't aware of. But there are also other causes of anemia that are not related to blood loss and are just inadequate intake of the things that we know are contributing to red cell development, things like vitamin B12, for example. So it depends on whether or not you have a microscopic anemia, small red blood cells, that's usually blood loss, or a macrocytic anemia, which is big red blood cells, which would be more of a nutrient deficiency. So lots of possibilities there, but definitely would stimulate the physician or provider to do some deep digging. More blood tests are going to be needed. We got one in the back, and then Linda, I'll get you next.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. Two-part question. If I'd like to read a little bit more about inflammation, do you have an author that you could recommend, perhaps not at where at level you would read? But that's one question. And the second is, why do you think there's so much more information coming out on alcohol? I appreciated that you had that slide, but it's now, you know, they're saying, well, now no amount of alcohol really is safe, and does it matter what you drink?
Yeah. So the answer to the first part of the question, the inflammation Bible is written by a guy named James Hebert, H-E-B-E-R-T. It looks like Herbert without the R, H-E-B-E-R-T, James Hebert. He's at University of South Carolina in Columbia. That's the whopper, but it's written at a level that's pretty scientific, but there's some chapters in there that I think are really more lay person directed. I'm not sure of a Barnes and Noble book that I would recommend about inflammation. Good question, but I don't know the answer. I don't have anything to recommend to you specifically. What was the second part of the question?
Alcohol.
it's my drinking. So it depends, you know, it really depends on who's got the mic. Right now, Murthy, the Surgeon General of the United States, is, you know, this is really one of his things that he's going to say. He wants this to be known, and it is true, that alcohol is clearly linked to an increased risk of 13 different cancers that we know of. The safest amount of alcohol in that case would be none. I would never recommend it to a non-drinker. I wouldn't say you need a drink for improved health. No way. if I enjoy it. I try not to drink it to excess. It's a lot that used to be considered excess. I mean, it was up to 7 drinks a week for women and up to 14 a week for men. I would probably try to limit it to 7 a week for everybody.
And I personally, I'm kind of like Peter Attia with this. I think he does a nice job of handling this question, this topic. I pick my battles. I've gotten in the habit of having it most days with dinner as a, just a habit and a social habit. I enjoy it. I like it paired with food. But I don't need to do that every day. And probably a smarter way to do it, if I'm honest, would be to pick those social instances. Don't drink it regularly. And if you have a friend who comes over and you have four people and you have a nice bottle of wine, you want to share a nice bottle of wine, that might be the time that I would go for it. So, you know, yes, zero's best. Up to 7 is tolerable. Up to 14 might be remotely tolerable in men, and anything beyond that is just a bad idea.
The coronary calcium scan that we had done at Mission was under $35. Not covered by insurance, but it was less than $35.
That's great. That's great. Thank you for that. It depends on where you go, but it is not. Don't expect it to be covered by insurance. But if it's $35, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, what do you think of the Beyond Meat, Beyond Sausage? Can I eat that?
It's a good question, too, because we use it. I see them as sort of transitional foods. I think they're far better for cows. Cows and pigs. I mean, there's no question. It's better for their health. It is not, I'm not convinced that it's necessarily better for your health. I mean, it is still a lot of processing, a lot of additives, a lot of saturated fat, for better or for worse. I wouldn't see it as a health food. I occasionally use them, very occasionally. I mean, once a quarter. You know, if somebody's over and they want to, I'm not going to eat your veggie chili. I want mine with meat. Well, I'll do Beyond Meat and not tell them. This is great. So, I wouldn't use them as a health food. I do find them useful for people who are experimenting with eating a more plant-forward diet. And I would say, hey, you know, try to incorporate these in. But there's some other things that we could do. Instead of putting the Beyond Meat in the chili, for example, I don't want to have to clean up all the mess. You know, I don't want to clean the pan. So I just throw some lentils in there, the red lentils in there, and let them be sort of the meat, if you will, the protein, if you will. There's a lot of fiber in there. There's a lot of protein in there. There's no cleanup, and it's just better for you. So long answer to a good question. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Do the GLP-1s have any effect on visceral fat?
Yes.
They reduce
you,
it?
You will lose visceral and subcutaneous fat, yes. It does. GLP-1s will reduce all of your body fat. I think that's the most fascinating class of medicines that I've seen in the last 20 years. They're now quickly being marketed for everything. You know, they're not just weight loss drugs now. They're good for your diabetes, for your brain health, and they're going to look for every other reason to market you this drug. And it is probably, to me, it just shows me how important fat loss, if you're over fat, over nourished, how important fat loss is to lots of health conditions. How you get there is, you know, that's tricky. So we're going to be seeing these going to be around a long time. I don't think they've replaced the fundamentals. And I think if you don't mind being on that medication for, injectable for the rest of your life, and, you know, it's better than the alternative. One up here first.
This is probably a stretch, but I was a heavy smoker and a heavy drinker. And 40 years ago, I quit smoking, and 38 years ago, I quit drinking. And there's a story circulating in the popular culture that the body repairs these things over time. I've never got a decent answer to that question. Is that really true, or is that not true? And maybe that's too broad of a question, but I wondered if you had any comment about that.
I think it's true and untrue. I think it's usually the answer is both. It depends on the damage. If you have alcohol-induced fatty liver disease, then that fat is reversible. If you have alcohol-induced fibrosis of the liver, early cirrhotic change, that is not going to be reversible. If you have, alcohol or smoke tobacco induced lung injury, yes, some of that is going to be cleaned out for sure. And we know that your risk after 1 year, your risk is cut in half. After 5 years, your risk is probably 20%, 80% reduced
for lung capacity.
For lung capacity. So some of that is reversible. But I think, you know, again, if you have early emphysema, then you're going to have emphysema. Yeah. So some of it is reversible and some of it is not. It's when you get scar tissue in the organs is when you can't get rid of scar tissue. But kudos to you for making those changes. I admire your courage. Yes, ma'am.
Could you repeat what you said about postbiotics?
Postbiotics. Prebiotics are the fiber that feed the probiotics, which are the bacteria, which produce the postbiotics, which are short-chain fatty acids, SCFA, short-chain fatty acids, and there are bunches of them. But acetate, butyrate, and propionate are the main three. And we're just learning about all the myriads of benefits of short-chain fatty acids. Bless you. So people are, of course, going to make those postbiotics and sell them to you. But you need not buy them. You could just eat them, or ultimately eat them. Yes, ma'am.
So this idea of taking a 10-minute walk after meals, is there a window for that? Like you have to do it within an hour or whatever?
Yep. Yes. So how many of you have worn a continuous glucose monitor? One of those little things you put on your... Yeah. I did the same, and it was very interesting. I thought it was very interesting. You know, you see diabetics wear them all the time, but they're now available to non-diabetics, just recently made available to non-diabetics, and you can ask your provider, healthcare provider, about having one if you're interested. It depends on what you ate. If you eat, if you drink Coke, you know, sugar water, and 12 teaspoons of sugar in a 12-ounce can of Coke, if you drink a Coke, it's a high glycemic load. You're going to have a very quick spike of your blood sugar. You should probably be, when you put the can down, you should probably be walking out the door. And you will see it blunt, that spike. If you're eating a low glycemic load food, low glycemic index food, say sweet potatoes, you're going to see a much more blunted response. It depends on what it is. If it's sugar and white flour, it's going to be about 10 to 15 minutes before it's peaked. And you got to get out. You got to get going now. If it's, you know, healthy carbs, sweet potato with Brussels sprouts and whatever else, it's going to be more like an hour before it peaks, and it's going to be a lower peak. And you can, you know, take your time with that and clean up. You can even do the dishes before you go walk. Janicki, questions upstairs?
Yes.
Online.
We have quite a few, so I'm gonna start reading them a lot, if that's all right.
Sure.
All right. So, the first one, someone is curious to know the connection between the autonomic nervous system and the inflammatory response, in particular to chronic pain.
Yeah, connection to the autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system consists of two branches, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And the sympathetic is the fight or flight. I guess it would be fight, flight, or freeze, and the parasympathetic is rest and digest. And we're mostly out of balance, as you can imagine, and we're really sympathetic predominant. And all these techniques that we talked about, restful sleep, meditation, yoga, painting, poetry, listening to music, whatever it is that allows you to tamp that down and reestablish that balance, is going to be anti-inflammatory. The same things that stimulate the sympathetic nervous system also are the things that release those pro-inflammatory hormones or compounds, molecules like cortisol, adrenaline, norepinephrine, epinephrine. So they are linked in that the same things cause them both. Inflammation and sympathetic overdrive are linked.
Okay, our next question is, can gluten cause inflammation?
Sorry, I missed it.
Can gluten cause gut, no, can gluten cause inflammation? There we go, sorry.
Certain people can. Gluten is a protein that's found in a lot of foods, a lot of wheat and other grains, whole grains. It is interesting to me. It's kind of reminiscent of the saturated fat conversation. Gluten is not a harmful protein in itself, as far as we can tell. Some people tolerate it very well. Some of us are sensitive to gluten, meaning that we get sort of a, you know, just gastric distress, you know, irritable bowel, just doesn't suit my intestines very well. I don't process it well. I just feel kind of yucky after I eat it. Other people are truly gluten allergic, and those people have celiac disease and can't eat any gluten because they will have really terrible inflammatory bowel problems. So most of us, if you think most of us who are, quote, gluten intolerant are simply intolerant and not truly allergic and don't have celiac, but most of us can eat, we think most of us can eat gluten with no problem.
Okay, next we have thoughts on Metamucil for gut health.
Yeah.
We need to wrap it up and one more question.
More question. So, and by the way, I know I talked too long, so I am happy to field questions. If there's some way to capture all the unanswered questions in the room and online, and some way of just sending me all the questions, I'm happy to give you my opinion as an answer to all those questions.
I'm able to save the chat and I can email it to you if that works.
That'd be great. If you want to do that, I'm happy. That would be great. I'll email me the whole chat,
mm-hmm.
and I will email you all the answers and you can distribute them.
Okay.
That note, we'll take your presentation also if you're willing to share it, as you
Absolutely.
Mentioned.
Of course.
And we'll post a note in the Observer as to
yeah.
how you can go about getting it there.
Yeah, I'm happy to Thanks. Hear everything. Yeah.
One more thing from online. On next Tuesday, the 25th at 4:30, one of our Ollie members, who she is on the chat today, she is giving a talk on personalized medicine, including the microbiome. And there is a Zoom link online. If you guys go onto the Ollie calendar, you can find it. And it's also in person as well. So just FYI for everyone.